Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 13th of October 2020. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on board tonight. Thanks very much for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. Very important show this evening. I have Alex from Nuggets News with me and we'll get going in just a second. Just before we do that, I just want to make sure that we just clear a couple of immediate things. This isn't financial advice. This is just a general conversation. Do please play nice in the chat room. The chat room is being moderated, of course, as normal. No racial slurs. This is as of the 13th of October if you're watching later. And if you want to get my attention to ask a question, use @WalkTheWorld. That's the best way to make sure that I see it. There's so much going on the chat, I don't necessarily see everything. Super Chat has been enabled, which means you can make a contribution to supporting us, but also make sure that your question goes to the top of the list. So if you want to make sure your question hits the top, use a super chat. So that's all I need to say. And without further ado, let me push a couple of buttons. The first one I'm going to push is that one, and the second one I'm going to push that is there. Alex, you should be now on.
Fantastic. Can you hear me okay, Martin?
Yeah, I might twiddle with the audio in a second, but it looks as though you might be a little bit down, but I can compensate for that. Thanks very much for spending some time. Notice your website is under development.
It is. I'm just making sure that it's got my right microphone. Cool. Okay. Yes, our website, after I've been saying we're upgrading our website and it's going to be ready in a couple of weeks for probably 6 months now because of COVID, unfortunately, Martin. So a lot of our business is our community, and part of that is a Facebook group, and we obviously want to get off Facebook. So we've been building our own standalone platform and an app, and that has taken a long time trying to do it working from home. With 23 staff now at Nuggets News. So hopefully, Martin, within a few days, that's all going to be up and running smoothly.
That's pretty good. And I also noticed you're getting close to 100,000 on YouTube as well, which is amazing.
I know. I think it ebbs and flows, doesn't it? Because there's times when I get jealous of you, when your channel is just going through the roof, when the housing stuff's, you know, topical, and then crypto becomes topical again and our channel starts to grow. So look, it's all going really well, and not as well as your flashy update though, Martin. That was very, very schmick, that little red across the screen.
Well, you know, I've been playing with the technology a bit. Unfortunately, the one thing that isn't working is my YouTube display of the conversations. We used to be able to do that. Unfortunately, they made an upgrade and it killed it. So waiting for support. Anyway, let's get started on the real topic, right? So this is a conversation tonight about this weird binary situation where on one hand we've got central banks frankly just printing, throwing more liquidity into the system, right? On the other hand, we've got digital, and you know, the traditional view, and if I'm wrong, tell me, is look, we know that the action of central banks is probably going to be inflationary, although we could touch on that later in more detail. Whereas if I take Bitcoin as an example, there's a finite number of Bitcoins, so therefore, by definition, it can't be inflated away the same. And would you agree with me that that's probably one of the critical things to get sort of clear first?
Yeah, I think so. But I'd probably go back even a step further. And for the people in the chat that don't even like Bitcoin or crypto at all, they're very skeptical of all that stuff. I think this is a different conversation, because even if Bitcoin and crypto don't catch on or for whatever reason, all the governments and central banks and commercial banks or retail banks, whatever you want to call them, depending on what country you're in, they're now talking about launching their own coins or cryptocurrencies or blockchains or ledgers, you know, whatever it may be. So that is almost a different conversation to whether or not you think Bitcoin and crypto is going to succeed or compete, or the decentralized stable coins. But cryptocurrency and digital currency, it's already here in some countries, and it's going to be, you know, every country will be using it, just like every government eventually used, you know, the internet, or they all went to the digital and card banking system and away from the gold standard. So yes, it's just the next, I guess, iteration and technical upgrade of how we're going to spend our money. And if you think about it, most money is already digital. They're phasing out cash and it's gone together in some countries. So we should talk about that, because it's all a scale of money to digital currency to cryptocurrency, and there's so many in-betweens.
Right. And, you know, I often say that the real tussle is in a way between the centralized and decentralized crypto world, right? In other words, the central bank digital currency. And there's a whole lot of developments that we should probably touch on there quite soon, insofar that there's been papers, you know, the Reserve Bank here issued a paper. There's been a paper from the Bank for International Settlements quite recently outlining their thinking as well. And there's also some interesting connection points where effectively people are saying, well, if a central bank can issue a digital currency, then they can actually control, for example, the value of currency much more. They can control where currency goes. So essentially, it's almost an additional tool set over and above the standard monetary tools, which frankly have pretty much failed so far as well. So the central banks are going into it because they're actually almost admitting defeat with regard to their normal tools.
Yeah, and I think the war on cash is also reared its head again just yesterday. The study from the CSIRO that said that COVID can survive for 28 days and cash and ATMs were two of the things they mentioned specifically when previous studies had shown that that wasn't an issue at all. So look, I think that all plays into this, the narrative that they have to create. They're here to help, they're here to solve a problem. And then sure enough, once it's everywhere and it's compulsory and you can't opt out, that's when people will start to learn, oh, hey, you know, my bank account got turned off, or there's negative interest rates that they're forcing me into. You know, all those usual things, Martin. They're going to on-sell that data to third parties. All those sort of bad things, they're doing it for more control. So definitely.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that people need to understand, that there is a, you know, an agenda, or at least a stream of consciousness which is now beginning to emerge. And I just want to sort of refer back to that BIS report, right, which actually came out this last week, because what they basically said in this report was that, you know, the journey towards central bank digital currencies is definitely on, but that they also are thinking as though somehow central bank digital currencies are just the digital equivalent of the controls that they have in the real world on steroids. That's the way I interpreted it, rather than potentially seeing it as something which is additive or indeed adding more flexibility or other things, right? It's almost like what they're doing is reading across from the old world into the digital world and applying old world thinking to that same new world environment. I don't know whether that's your perspective, but that's what I see when I read it.
Yeah, to me, I've sort of seen this coming for a long time. And even 18 months ago, the central bankers were saying that crypto is just this niche little thing. It's not a threat. It's not going to affect monetary policy or our decisions or anything like that. And here we are with every central bank in the world now talking about it. I think China were on the front foot first with their digital yuan. And they like to say that, hey, it's ready soon. And just this week, they've announced that they're giving away some to millions of people as a bit of a trial. And all of a sudden, all the other central banks, they've got to hurry up because they don't want to have egg on their face and let China be this complete world leader in the digital currency space. So yesterday or last week, they all got together. They tried to agree on some standards because they obviously want to try and get their currencies to be able to talk to each other or be exchanged very easily, which is sort of how things work in the crypto world, where there's a set of standards and then everything integrates and it's all composable. So I guess that's the kind of guidelines that they are putting forward, again, for how they're going to share all the data and be able to watch everything that each other does, I'm sure, as well. So yes, the race was on. Nobody wanted to be first. Now nobody wants to be last. I find myself saying that so often at the moment because we've reached this point where everything is just really accelerating. But where I think that a lot of people are still completely unaware, if you're not into crypto, is that there's already dozens of stable coins that are growing, you know, 100% month on month in terms of their growth. And so we're now in the realms of tens of billions of dollars already in some of these stable coins that are being used around the world. And so all these other government coins, or when JP Morgan says we're going to launch our own coin, JP coin, whatever it is, Facebook want to launch Libra, I'm sure that other big techs will get into that game. And it's all just a scale about, well, is that a currency? Is it a stable coin? Is it a basket? But they're all going to want their own monies and they're all going to want control. And I think the big point is that the centralized, the thing that they can turn on and off, they can stop your account, share your data, that is all the opposite end of the spectrum to the Bitcoins and the decentralized stable coins, where it's empowering you rather than taking things away.
Right, and I think that's really important to understand, right? So there is still the decentralized, no central control of Bitcoin, where effectively it's all to do with that ledger, and then there's a degree of anonymity, although of course there's more control than there used to be there, whereas central banks want to control the monetary system, they want to control the flow of cash, and they want to be able to use all of their monetary policy levers through this new world that they're now thinking about. So in a way, it's becoming even more polarized, it seems to me. And unfortunately, people, I think, are confusing a little bit the technology from the business and finance strategy that's actually now starting to drive it, right? Because I have a feeling that a few years ago, this was technology looking for somewhere to go. Now I think the thing's switched. And I do think that there are significant evidence that, you know, central banks in particular are now seeing this as a major opportunity. Here's my narrative, Alex, and that is that the central bank's strategy so far, of which is basically to throw more liquidity into the system and do more quantitative easing to try and actually save the economies around the world, is failing, right? They keep having to throw more liquidity in. It just gets a bigger and bigger and bigger number, but there's very little evidence yet of any success of those strategies. It didn't work a decade ago. Why would it work now? So if, in fact, the current central bank strategies aren't working, then they have to reach for some new tools. And that's where the central bank digital currency tool comes in. So that's one of the reasons why it's so very much on the cards at the moment. And then, as you mentioned, stablecoins, I think that's something else that people need to get their heads around, right? Because effectively the idea of stablecoins is it's connected to something else. And that could be a single other currency or a basket of currencies or something else. And the idea is there to reduce, I guess, instability and the moves of the market, because Bitcoin has been somewhat volatile. Although, interestingly, you could argue, I think, that Bitcoin has been a little less volatile compared with where it was earlier on. So maybe scale is beginning to have benefits even there.
Yeah, Bitcoin is at multi-year. If you look at the sort of average rolling 30-day volatility, it's very calm at the moment. And I think just today, over the weekend, we had a $1,000 move up. And I do think that we are on the cusp of that next sort of big bull market, because everyone is talking about crypto once again. But just to address those first few points of yours, Martin, yes, I agree that it's sort of been covered as a technology play and portrayed that way. But like you said, with monetary policy, look at even the meetings that they've held lately, and they're talking about inflation. You know, we need to get inflation up. It hasn't worked. And they've tried to put that money and put that liquidity into the system. A lot of it has gone into asset markets. The wealthy get it first if it doesn't sit in the bank as just reserves at the Treasury. And so this is a tool for them to have a digital way to go direct to customers. So the Fed absolutely love that idea, and they're setting the narrative now, the backdrop, starting to talk about welcoming inflation, starting to talk about negative interest rates. They're just putting all those chess pieces in place. So when they implement this, people are going to, you know, it's trying to normalize it. But then there's two other aspects to it. So obviously the Fed and the central bank, they want that power to be able to hopefully spur inflation and save face, because they haven't been able to get that. But if they take that tool away, that's all the banks that used to get those reserves, and they get to lend and they get to make money. So the commercial banks would lose a lot of power in that situation. And just look at all the laundering that's going on around the world, you know, FinCEN documents. So that system is way worse than the crypto system. And they don't really want to have a ledger that's almost prying on them. You know, those commercial banks will want something that's private so they can keep doing all the bad stuff. And then you've also got governments that are in this situation where they're starting to talk about, well, you know, monetary policy is losing its power. We need more fiscal spending. And so they want a tool that allows them to spend directly. They don't have to wait for the Fed to give them some money or, you know, sell some bonds. They can kind of just create up, just like how most governments around the world actually still mint their own coins and notes. That's one of the few things that they are responsible for and can kind of create. So now that becomes, well, can they theoretically start to just mint their own digital currencies? And how does that affect the monetary policy of, you know, the Fed and, you know, commercial banks and the loans and that whole system? So it's a really confusing system, but now all those three different players all want the power, because whoever has a ledger can basically do everything. And then outside of that world, you've got the competing Bitcoin and other digital currencies.
Yeah, very interesting. And talk about dynamic. I mean, this is as dynamic as it gets, right? There are so many moving parts. But I also want to highlight the extensivity of digital, right, into digital ID, social scores, track and trace. There was a legislation passed recently in Australia to allow basically photographs to be used more widely for all sorts of purposes, right? And China, I guess, is probably one of the leading examples of where this is going. They do seem to be further down the road, as it were, in terms of actually the integration of all these various elements. And I guess the question I have is, what does it do to personal freedom, right? And do we actually end up in a world that is essentially controlled? And who is controlling, and who calls the shots?
Yeah, it definitely does. And we've probably already gone past that mark. And it's the case that a lot of these people in government, particularly in the US, I think the average age of congressmen and women is over 60, and they don't understand this technology. So even when they call in Mark Zuckerberg for the day, some of them are asking them, the most basic questions, and they don't understand the internet or an app, let alone what is going on with all the data. And it's going to be the same. We've already seen it with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So it's very important to have all that education about what's going on. But once again, the commercial banks and the Fed, they're going to pull the wool over the eyes of the policymakers. They're going to lobby to the right people. They're going to do everything they can to get their way. And even if they can't, I mean, they've already got money and those licenses and that power, so that they can sort of pivot slightly, or maybe they go aggressively after developing countries where there's more population. They see that as a huge opportunity. I'm not sure. But either way, money has gone more and more digital. This is just the next step. But the scary thing is that this is so much more powerful than anything that's previously been out there. And once they have that ledger, as you said, Bitcoin's kind of pseudonymous. So there's ways that you can use it privately if you're extremely careful and you don't buy it off an exchange where they have all your details and such. But in these government or banking ledgers, they're going to have every data point about you attached to that ledger, GPS tracking, your habits. That's all worth a fortune. So not only to companies that want to buy that, but on the dark web and to hackers and to the bad people, and sometimes it ends up going full circle where the companies are buying that data off the dark web because they couldn't get it by legitimate means. So yes, data is the new oil. This opens up that whole world about everything you're doing, and you're just a customer. You're just good money to these big corporations.
Right. And I think the point you make about some of the legislators not really being fully across all of this stuff and understanding what's going on, I think is very good. I also have a question as to whether some of the central bankers really understand what they're getting into as well. I don't know whether they do or whether they don't, because they do seem to be conflicted in terms of some of the things that they're saying. So, for example, the Reserve Bank in Australia in their last particular report said, well, we're keeping a watching brief, but we're not going to do much at the moment, although they are actually doing some tests, I think, and experimenting even here in Australia. So, perhaps what they say and what they write is not the same. What's your sense there? Do you think the central banks really know what they're getting into, or are they basically making it up as they go along?
Are we talking about normal monetary policy, Martin, where they know what they're doing or not, or crypto?
I was thinking of the both and, actually. I mean, I argue that they're not really doing what they think they're doing with regard to normal monetary policy, right? And I'm reading across that and assuming that the truth may also be the same in crypto land and with the central bank digital currencies.
Absolutely. No, I was just being a bit cheeky and stirring up there, Mark, because as Steve Keen always says, and he was someone that I first learnt off about 10 or 12 years ago now around that financial crisis when he was out there doing that speaking and saying central banks, their models don't work. The models don't account for banks' debt and money. And I was thinking, like, is this guy crazy? And sure enough, over time, Steve's got a lot of things, I guess, wrong because of the monetary policy and what they've done. And I think, like mathematically, or if there was a free market, a lot of this wouldn't have been able to go on this long, or the prices of stocks and housing probably wouldn't have gone up this far. But I still think his premise about how that economists and central banks, the way that they think the world works and those couple of levers is not the reality. And just last week we saw Ian McFarlane come out on Joe's podcast, Jolly Swagman, and he really spoke about how there's big demographics in play. And when you've got that boom and you've got the spending and everything's going up, central banks think that they're doing a wonderful job. And when things got overheated and they took rates to 17%, you know, lo and behold, they could slow things down. But in between that, it's kind of been maybe just consequence, or the market ebbs and flows, and they don't really have the stabilizing effect that they thought. And if you actually look at it, every crash has got bigger. And I think they knew that was going to happen again a few months ago. And that's why they went hard early, you know, $3 trillion. Well, the GFC was that big bailout that took ages to debate, and it was, what, $700 or $800 billion. So I think they are very aware. And even Ian McFarlane said the other day, there's been emails leaked. Jerome Powell, I think 8 years ago when he first joined the board of the Federal Reserve, he said that this isn't good. If we keep going down this path, we can never take away the punch bowl. If markets go up, they will cheer us. And every time we try and pull it away, you know, markets will fall. So he said that. He knew what was going to happen. And when he first got brought in as chairman, he said that almost publicly. And then he did the backflip a few months later when markets started to crash. So I think it's now just all a game of bluffing. They've actually started to talk about how jawboning and forward guidance, are basically just talking and saying things, is a tool that they consider that moves markets. So I think it's all a game of smoke and mirrors while they manage things month to month, meeting to meeting. And in the world of crypto, they've got absolutely no idea about how this stuff. I mean, they'll try and get up to speed, and they might learn it faster than the average person because they understand more. But the world of crypto, there is truly so much to understand. It does take years, and they are behind the eight ball, yeah.
Right. So what does that mean then for those people who, you know, are backing Bitcoin as basically the winner, right? Because there is going to be a tussle. We know there is going to be a tussle between devolved, centralized, central bank, digital currencies, you know, stable coins. What's your read on all of that? I mean, is Bitcoin at a particular point in its evolution where it can withstand all of this? Or do you think it's ultimately going to get steamrolled by some of this other stuff that's coming through?
Yeah, I mean, you often hear people say that governments will never let it win, or banks will never let it win. And we're nearly coming into Bitcoin's 12th year now, and it's had everything, I guess, thrown at it over that time. And Bitcoin is already the sixth largest currency in the world by market cap. So, you know, just let that sink in. If you take out the big currencies around the world, you know, US dollar, world reserve currency, and then you go down the list of those currencies that are in the basket of the special drawing right, China, Japan, UK, EU. And then you've got Bitcoin that's already at 200 and something billion. So I think that people forget there's 200 countries around the world. There's lots of these currencies, and Bitcoin has already surpassed those, and it's getting a lot of adoption in those countries. They tend to be the ones that have the worst monetary policy, hyperinflation, no banks. Even if they do have a banking system, people are unbanked and it's very hard to get an account, or there's not a branch in the region that you live in. In a lot of those places now, we're seeing high smartphone penetration. So people that, you know, live in these houses with dirt floors, these days they still have a smartphone. Smartphones now cost like $20 in some of these countries. They've got a little solar panel on their roof and they can get some internet, or we've got more and more satellites now. The Bitcoin network actually has some satellites. So even if the power grid goes down, you know, it keeps updating. So I just think that Bitcoin is, it's almost unstoppable because it's just math. It's just a program that everyone has and anyone can install it at any time and start running it. So it's very hard to say that, you know, an app or a bit of software is illegal. I think that Bitcoin is just this sponge. And as people learn about it and they say, here's this thing that doesn't get printed more each year. This year, the US dollar printed 22. People are now talking about 27%, and it looks like by the end of the year, you know, that is an enormous amount of inflation for the world reserve currency. And that's why people like MicroStrategy put in $500 million off their balance sheet and said that the US dollar is eroding. It's not a good place for us to keep our money as a business. You've got Paul Tudor Jones. You've got Square, you know, this week just gone. So one by one, I think it's now a dozen listed companies that are traded on the NASDAQ and stock exchanges around the world have got Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Then you've got a heap of private companies, you know, millions of investors now, and there's billions of people that have or need a way to store money and value. And it's becoming clearer and clearer that whether it's this crisis that was probably already, you know, economies were slowing down and they were starting to blame the, you know, the bushfires and climate change, remember, about how the central banks were going to need to save us. So everything that you look at, the unfunded liabilities, you know, slowing down demographics, it's very clear they're going to have to print enormous amounts of money. And if people can say, well, hey, you know, I can hold gold or silver, they can't print more of that. The world is going more and more digital. And even if you're watching the channel and you don't like Bitcoin, you think it's all, you know, backed by nothing and whatnot, you know, you're going to get older. And the people that are younger that have grown up with this stuff, that have all these currencies in their games and their apps, that is just normal for them. So it's just a matter of time for me, as Bitcoin is this sponge that it absorbs more money.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that's exactly right. I mean, my learning curve has been relatively fast on this because, you know, I've been trying to track it over the last few years and, you know, seeing where it's going and trying to see where it can go. And that's always the interesting part. And, you know, a lot of the early discussion was, well, the blockchain is the really interesting thing rather than the Bitcoin part as well. But it does seem to me now that if you look at the number of large financial companies and other investment houses that are holding Bitcoin directly, that has been a game changer. And I'm not sure necessarily that people understand just how much of it is now held by institutions, right? And institutional investors, and they are in it for the long haul. And that's another reason why I suspect that this is some, you know, an unstoppable train. And that's probably why some of the central banks are a bit nervous, right? Because essentially, if it goes that way, then the question becomes, well, what is the role of a central bank then?
I think the biggest Achilles heel, or the one thing that could make Bitcoin far less appealing, is if central banks acted responsibly. If they if they weren't printing 22% a year and they weren't thinking about negative interest rates, if the derivatives weren't causing people to be nervous about the, you know, the European banking system, and if you just go down the list of everything that is wrong with the financial system, that's people putting people's money at risk, you know, bail-ins, bailouts. You know, if none of that was there, then there'd be no need for Bitcoin. But the fact is that they are all there. And as I said before, in some countries, you use Bitcoin because you can't get a bank account or you can't start an online business and accept donations like WikiLeaks or a tattoo parlor. Or you know, there's lots of legitimate businesses that are a little bit taboo and the banking system won't touch them. And in Australia, the new system that they want to go to is forcing everyone into that system. So, you know, all the crypto businesses in Australia, they find it really hard and they've all had their accounts shut down. So, you know, does that just mean that they can't run a business anymore because the banks won't bank them? So again, one by one, there's just more and more reasons. And Bitcoin doesn't have to be the best thing ever and be number one in Australia and the US and these places with pretty decent payment systems. But there's billions of people out there who are not served well. And one by one, more people are going to join and start using for those reasons.
Somebody's just put a comment to say, oh, I've done a backflip on Bitcoin. Don't think I have. I've always said it's speculative, right? Well, I still think it is speculative. But what is changing is this adoption by large financial institutions. It's almost becoming a mainstream thing, right? And that's the change.
Well, if I could ask you, Martin, I mean, I know you weren't really a fan of, say gold either. Hmm. But when someone like Warren Buffett, that's hated gold for 20 or 30 years, says he's going into gold with a big allocation because of a lot of the same reasons. Look, I'm still a big gold and silver fan because the big institutions like pension funds, they can't really just put $100 billion in Bitcoin like they would if they've got to get out of bonds, for example, or trillions of dollars in bonds. I think they will probably go into gold, but Bitcoin's growing. So have you changed your opinion on something like gold because of what's happening and seeing people like Warren Buffett change their mind?
Well, look, I mean, this is a start of a longer conversation, but look, here's the argument, right? Here's my argument. Everybody, most people probably are assuming that there is going to be an inflationary future, right? Because effectively all of this central bank liquidity that's being created, right, is basically seen as extra liquidity, which is going to pump up the cost of everything. Therefore, we're going to get big inflation. Therefore, what you need to do is to hold assets that actually hold their value, like gold or even cryptos, right? Because they potentially have more capacity to sustain value in a environment where everything else is being devalued. And so that's the sort of the classic argument as to why you should go into gold. Now, my problem is I'm not convinced by that argument, right? Because I actually think if you look carefully, a lot of the printing that's being done, and I use printing in inverted commas, it's often transfer from one type of assets to another type of assets is leading to greater fees of liquidity into the banks, right? So there's no doubt about it. Money supply has gone through the roof. It's up 11% here in Australia this year, right? Which is huge. It's up 25%, I think, in the US over that same period. Massive, right? But it only will have an impact on the real economy if that money gets lent out again.
I agree with that, yes.
And the problem we've got at the moment is, if you look carefully, demand for credit is not there, right? Mm-hmm. So if you actually are in a situation where you've got all this money coming in and, you know, the Fed is putting liquidity in, the Reserve Bank is putting liquidity in very cheap rates, they're keeping the yield curves way down to try and reduce the cost of lending, all of that's fine. But if there is nobody wanting, willing and able to borrow, then you don't get the old multiplier effect. You don't get the, you know, remember that the whole idea of this is banks create money, right? They then actually put it in the system and that creates growth in the economy. The other point is, as people pay down debt, that's deflationary, right? That actually reduces the total amount of money sloshing around the system. And at the moment, if you look carefully at the statistics, a lot of people are deleveraging, which is deflationary, right? So question is the future going to be inflationary or deflationary? If it's going to be inflationary, then sure, gold and other assets like that are, provide some protection. In a deflationary world, it's a whole new ballgame, right? And that's where I'm, so I'm caught at the moment. I actually don't know which way it's going to go, but there are some quite compelling arguments on the deflationary side, which most people just dismiss as not being that very relevant and basically go back to that sort of, no, gold is the way to go. You know, gold has never lost its value. It's always worth holding. And then they quote Warren Buffett and other people. By the way, Warren Buffett went mostly into miners rather than holding gold itself, which is in itself quite interesting, right? So that's sort of, that's the thing that I'm sort of, you know, caught on at the moment. I can make arguments both ways, but at the moment, I actually think deflation is most likely than inflation. And then look at Japan, look at the Eurozone.
Yes. Well, if I can, I guess, rebut that, I think I agree that there's so many deflationary forces. So we know the usual ones about debt, as you said, demographics. I think digitization and just technology is hugely deflationary, as we know. Another kind of buzzword that starts with D, decentralization, with people working from home. So there's going to be less concentrations of wealth in CBDs, which I think is a real game changer. And that kind of goes hand in hand with technology, because you can do more from home as well. And that one of the books behind me is Harry Dent's book, which is one of the first that I read as well. And he talks a lot about that deflation and all those sort of things. Now, what I think central banks are so much more fearful of deflation than inflation, and they've been printing all this money, it's got more and more and more, and they still can't get in inflation. So they're not scared of inflation anymore like they used to be. But if things start going down in price, people start paying down debt, that becomes a nastier spiral. So that's why they're already starting to talk about, hey, we want to welcome inflation, run the economy hot. And who, my point here, Martin, tying it all together, is who is going to say no to free money, whether it's another $1,200, whether it's UBI, whatever we want to call it, whether it's tax cuts. They are now starting to do things to put more money straight into the hands of the average user. And so I think that it's always, even if it starts to tip into the inflationary realm, it's always going to be fought really hard, rather than the other way where they're saying, well, if it gets a little bit too inflationary, we're going to run the economy hot. So I kind of think that that path is just becoming more and more likely, which strengthens the bull case for those assets. Yeah.
Right. And then let's just go back to digital, because obviously the way that you would do this is, if you were going to put helicopter money into the system, is you'd actually do it digitally, right? You'd actually give people the digital equivalent, right? And then, by the way, you can put a fuse on that to say you've got to spend it within 6 months or it disappears, right? Gives you much more incentive to try and get people to spend, because they need people to spend, right? The whole rationale of central banking is, we need more activity, we need more growth, because that's the only way that we can actually take the economy into a, you know, wherever they want to take it, right?
I agree.
Yeah.
The thing I was going to say, the beautiful thing here, if they go down that path, is, let's say that they program in, you've got to spend it within a month. It's got a negative 5% interest rate. So you get penalized, you've got to spend it. people that are now tech savvy can say, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'm going to spend it, and maybe I'm going to buy some Bitcoin, or maybe I'm just going to buy a stable coin rather than use their coin, because the stable coin can't punish me. And if they say, well, no, you can't do that, once again, every time the government's trying to patch one hole, you know, another hole pops up somewhere. So you can go out and buy a gift voucher or buy some gold and then go trade that for Bitcoin or a stable coin. There's peer-to-peer markets. So, you know, they're never going to be able to stop money sort of flowing into different things. Now, a lot of people aren't going to take the time to learn about all that, and they'll sit there and complain that they're getting penalized, blah, blah, blah. But this is why I'm so passionate about education in this space, because I think it's just going to be such a way to protect yourself, as well as hopefully as a good investment that makes money. But if nothing else, it's just get out of the system, protect yourself, have those options where you know how to pivot into a stable coin, pivot into gold, pivot into Bitcoin, if that's what you sort of need to do.
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, the concept of being forced to spend, right? You know, there's a really interesting observation. Savings actually is deflationary, right, firstly, rather than inflationary, because it takes money out of the system, right, as well as repaying loans. And in fact, the last thing that people, you know, who are running central banks want you to do is to save. They actually want you to spend. They want you to consume. They want to drive this economic engine harder and harder and harder. So they will do everything they possibly can to drive that engine harder, right? Unfortunately, it's not necessarily great strategy, because basically you end up consuming more and more and more and basically running out of planet. But that's another story, right? I mean, it's part of the story.
I completely agree. And it's something that my grandpa, who's no longer with us, used to talk to me a lot about. And I really wanted to actually do an episode with him, because to talk about the old days and what it was like. And it's just so much different. And we've kind of had that privilege taken away from us. Or another way to frame it is, when did they decide that we are not allowed to save money? Or why should you be penalized for trying to save money? Or these people that work in, you know, I know it's not Australia or the US yet, but what about the people that do wake up to these countries and 40% is devalued overnight? Or, you know, you're getting this bail-in or whatever it is, ATMs are empty, your kids can't eat that day. There's, you know, it's one by one just being treated like, you know, those personal freedoms and liberties, it's just being eroded. So I know that's kind of a little bit, it seems out there, but the thing is that it's happening in more and more countries. And people don't think that it's out there until it's not outside their window. And then one day it will be. And by that stage, it's sort of normally too late.
Yes. And the point there, I think, is really important, that these things happen step by step by step by step, right? So it's not like somebody suddenly reveals the big plan and say, ta-da, that's what we're going to do over the next 3 or 4 years, right? Yeah. There's a series of incremental steps that are taken. And then you look back and think, hang on a moment, look what's just happened, right? That's what I feel we're in the middle of at the moment, you know, a series of incremental things, but actually taking us into a direction where personal freedoms are eroded, where more control is being essentially placed, and where, in fact, choices that we have today are actually being taken away. I mean, the old cash ban was a great example, right, of something which basically took away the ability to do things that we could have done previously. That is something that people need to keep a really close eye on, because that's the way that policies are actually being implemented.
Again, if you had have said to, you know, your parents, I think, you know, people have maybe, I don't know if soft is the right word, but just almost laid down in a lot of respects. If Josh Frydenberg had to go out there in public to some of these suburbs and say, hey guys, you know, we're going to penalize you, we're going to take 5% of your money, negative interest rates and whatever, you know, people would not have taken that back in the day. But I think, yeah, it's just times have changed a little bit now, where they just seem to be trying to get away with more and more. The other thing, I guess, that frustrates me about all this, and we've spoken about this, is that it comes back to the financial system and governments, and they're so worried about too much debt, or in Australia, they're so worried about getting that surplus. But I think what we're finding out now with all these models and that is that, whether or not you want to call it MMT, but the idea that we're even debating whether or not we should be saving people that you've told and you've ended their businesses and their careers, and they're facing losing their family home and their kids might be hungry and whatever, you know, it should not even be an argument that you should try and support those people and give them money. And that's not going to cause inflation. Now, that's not irresponsible government spending. That's, you know, because we can create our own currencies. So that's where I used to be one of those people that thought, you know, oh, you can't let governments do that and whatever. But if they lose their job, they're on $1,000 a week, and now you're giving them $1,000 a week or whatever it is just to get by, you know, what are the side effects? I know there's a number on a screen that says there's more debt, but everything else is equal in that economy, and it's not nasty causing inflation or anything bad. And that's where I think, again, it's just that lack of understanding from governments, economists themselves not understanding that model. And I think it's all gonna change. And we'll look back on this kind of thing and be like, you know, this is, look at what we were doing to people, putting them in these situations, all because we didn't understand things. And, you know, I'm a pharmacist by trade, and it's like that in the world of medicine where people look back and go, you know, I can't believe we used to do this, that, and the other. And it was just the kind of way it was. And yeah, I think things will change.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And somebody's just on the stream here, so you reminded me of the story of the frog, right? You turn the temperature up slowly and the frog doesn't notice until it's cooked, right? That's yes. That's a bit like what's going on. Somebody else also asked, Sharpies, I think, said, why is Australia slow compared to other countries in crypto, digital currency and electric cars? Is there any sort of common theme there, do you think?
I would have said the opposite. So in terms of speculation and retail adoption, Australia is right up there in terms of the number of people that are investing. We've got so many crypto exchanges. As you said before, Martin, make sure you stick to the top one or two or three, because there's a lot of scams out there. But in the number of people per capita that are investing, I think it would be like very meaningful 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of Australians, because you look at the numbers of these exchanges, and a lot of them have, you know, 300,000, 400,000. I've heard a couple of them say, you know, we're getting right up there in terms of compared to other countries. Now, in the professional side of things, there is a fair bit of clarity around securities, whether or not something is a security, but we don't have a lot of security tokens or securities. A lot of the cryptos are kind of currencies or utility tokens. And that's where there is still a little bit of uncertainty, and a lot of people I know in the startup world have, you know, left Australia, or they'll go elsewhere because for that reason. So yes, we're behind in some ways, but in others, you've been able to pay every bill in Australia in crypto since 2014 on a website called Living Room of Satoshi. There's a lot of these exchanges that have cards, so you can buy your groceries every week with Bitcoin. You know, not many countries in the world have that at all, and we've had it for years.
Yeah, good point. And a couple of people in the chat were saying, well, you know, there's a government intervention perhaps, or lack of intervention with electric cars. But just on the question of exchanges, I've had a couple of people ask before the show, how do you tell whether an exchange is a kosher exchange or not? It's not necessarily always straightforward, is it?
No. So I was a board member of Blockchain Australia for 2 years, and they are the industry body that certifies the exchanges. So the ones that I know you've had on the show, Independent Reserve, BTC Markets, CoinSpot, there's a few others, but if you go to the website, they'll have a stamp of approval, a certification. So I would stick to those big trusted ones. If you're new, once you get the hang of things, if there's another exchange that you know and understand and trust, but basically, if your friend tells you to get something or go to this one, or they're offering this or whatever, it's like, it's always too good to be true in the crypto space. So just play it safe. Yeah.
Right. Interesting on that. And one other question which I received before the show was, what's the most popular digital currency being used by businesses in Australia? Have you got any sense of that?
Well, there's one going around at the moment that I think is a big scam. So I'm not sure if I should mention it or not, but Bitcoin is the most used. Yeah. In Queensland, there's a lot, like there's a bit more of a Bitcoin Cash community. In other places, there'll be like little towns that might like Litecoin or XRP, the Ripple coin. So I think it's a little bit of everything, a splash of everything. There's a lot of Aussie dollar stable coins that are starting to pop up, but they don't have a lot of use or, volume yet. So it all depends. But at the moment, Bitcoin is by far the biggest. And Ethereum is, we might get into this a whole other conversation, that is more of a kind of a technology play rather than just trying to be a currency. Yeah.
I mean, I have covered a few of those dimensions on other shows, because, you know, once you start unpacking this, you realize that it's not all the same, right? There's coins, there's currencies, there's transfer mechanisms, there's all sorts of things in this digital world, and yes. You know, it's quite an interesting but complex map. One of the questions which again I got beforehand is, how do you determine the capitalization, you know, the market cap of a digital currency? Is that easy to do or hard to do?
It's most of them are all pretty transparent on these blockchains, and then it's just the last traded price, the same as shares. So the last traded price multiplied by the supply, and you get the value on the market cap. Now that can be slightly misleading. Obviously, there's only a very small percentage of coins that get traded that day, and someone pays a really high price. Everyone that owns that coin thinks, oh wow, you know, all my coins are worth this amount. So it comes back to liquidity and volume, a little bit like penny stocks, or people that have dabbled in that space will know, just because the number on the screen says that your 1 cent stocks jumped up to a dollar, if you tried to sell for a dollar, the price might fall all the way back to 50 cents. And it's the same in the crypto world.
Okay, thanks for that. And another question's come in as well, and that's about the speed of Bitcoin, because a number of people have said, you know, Bitcoin is not up for it in terms of becoming mainstream because it's too slow. Is that still true?
Yeah, that is true at the moment. So Bitcoin can only do around 7 transactions per second. The main hope to scale that is the Lightning Network. There's other side chains that we've currently got that the exchanges are using to send coins to each other. In the next 12 to 24 months, there's 2 or 3 things that could scale Bitcoin a lot. Some people are already talking about the fact that we don't really need to, and you've got to start to think about Bitcoin as the base layer currency. And then on top of that, you build your payment rails and second and third layers even. So we might go down that path. And in that regard, you might have heard in the news that you can now put Bitcoin onto Ethereum. You know, I won't go down the technical route of how that works, but it's, you know, it's only been like that for a few months now. We've already seen $1 billion worth of Bitcoin is now on Ethereum, and because that is a better maybe rails system, you can think of it as. So all these problems are basically being solved, and I think it's like the internet in the early days. Yes, you couldn't watch HD movies in the mid-90s, but 10 years later, you know, they tinkered and they made things more efficient, and that's where crypto is at the moment. It needs to get better, but it will get better.
And here's a wonderful question from Madeline. Can you explain to me how non-government issued Bitcoin and digital currencies are legal? I really don't get it. Now, define legal, I suppose, is the point there, isn't it?
Yeah, whenever someone says, you know, is it legal or will it get banned? You've got to say, well, you know, where? So even if Bitcoin is illegal in some countries, but again, if you can get on the internet, if you have a mobile device, anyone can download a Bitcoin wallet and start using it. So people can decide that anything has value. There's people out there that collect Pokemon cards, baseball cards, you know, gold coins. Bitcoin was the first one that was out there, so it has that first mover advantage. Then it has a track record that it's never been hacked, or the network's never gone down over that 12 year period. So yes, you hear about the websites being hacked and people that lost their password, but Bitcoin itself has never been hacked. And now we've got companies like Microsoft building projects on top of Bitcoin, which is really exciting because of how strong that network is as well. So yeah, I do think that we are going to get better and better, more and more uses. There's regulatory clarity now, you know, the SEC, the CFTC in America, and they're probably the most important in terms of financial markets. They've basically given Ethereum and Bitcoin the stamp of approval, saying they're not securities, they're regulated, they're traded on futures markets. We haven't quite got an ETF yet, but in other countries, you know, some are calling it property still, some are calling it a commodity, some are currency, a collectible, some don't have a definition for it. So it's square peg, round hole type stuff. It doesn't fit any of those other definitions, or it is multiple. So I think you kind of need new regulation in some ways, but I'm sure some people will make it illegal, but it doesn't really matter. You can only slow it down.
Right, and that is an interesting point, of course. And if you follow the argument to say central bank digital currency is trying to try and win, one of the steps they could take is to try and make it illegal, but I think it will be quite hard to do given, you know, the way that it's evolved so far.
Well just quickly, I've never been that bullish on privacy coins because I thought they would be the first to go. And that's this year, we've really seen that happen. All the exchanges had to delist the majority of privacy coins. And what's happened in the weeks since that occurred is the prices started drifting higher and higher. And so you go down this road of, you know, a lot of things on the black market, or every time the government try to stamp something out, it makes it more valuable and more people try to get into that market because it creates an incentive and a problem people will pay to be solved. So privacy coins are going up in price since they got banned. Maybe that would happen to Bitcoin too. I'm not sure.
And it's quite interesting. I've had a couple of people on the chat saying, you know, there are people who think that Bitcoin snake oil and it's completely, you know, a scam, right? And it's like, yeah, hang on a moment. Just think about our existing financial system, right? How stable is that? And to what extent are there actually, you know, things going on in our normal financial system that you would also question as well? I almost think we try and make this sort of artificial polarization between, you know, the Bitcoins and everything else, which perhaps isn't totally fair either way.
Yeah, no, it is so funny that in the last few weeks, the US came out and said all banks are allowed to hold cryptocurrencies for their customers now. Again, big tick of approval. Then they came out and said, we need to make sure that all the stable coins are backed one for one. So we don't want a situation where there's a fractional reserve because people are trading these very frequently, like kind of like a constant bank run. And what they said was, hey, we could have a stable coin run and the bank could collapse. But I was thinking, hold on. You've just said that they have to be one for one backed. And you've got every other asset in the bank that's fractionally reserved, and you're saying that stable coins are a threat to the financial system. Again, it's just, this stuff is just so backwards.
Yeah. It's one rule over there and one rule over here. In fact, it should be the same set of rules, right? That's the key point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we're in this state of evolution. But going back to our earlier point again, you know, the central banks are desperate to try and find additional tools. They're going to reach for some of these things. They're going to. So I'm expecting more unnatural acts as they try and sort of navigate through here. But there is a broader conversation around, you know, the future of electronic payments and digital currencies and those sorts of things. And I think the point you made right at the top of the show, just want to reemphasize, most transactions today are digital now. Right. It's not like we're talking about 2% of the total economy. Right. Most transactions are just electronic.
That is exactly what I was about to go back to as well, Martin, because once people have this idea or they see this coin in their app and they say, why is there, you know, there was $10 trillion and now there's $12 trillion this year. You know, there's 20% more and my slice of the pie has gotten smaller. And then they see this other coin that is going up in value. And yes, it is volatile, but over time, I believe it's going to continue to grow because it's taking money from all these other systems and assets. And you've got one coin that's pegged to a dollar. And not only that, that dollar is getting eroded in value, or you've got another coin that is going up in value and it's scarce and getting more scarce. So over time, I believe it's just a no-brainer that it is going to win unless something changes. But all else remaining equal, just on those two things, supply and demand, that's not a speculative statement. That's just supply and demand. And maths would say one asset goes up.
Yeah. Well, I think we're definitely at a sort of point of inflection, as I've said a few times on other shows. My sense is, you know, we've sort of gone through the foothills. We're now in this next evolution, and that evolution is moving very quickly. Not sure where it's going to head yet, but we should definitely not just dismiss it as complete nonsense, right? There's a lot of unknown still, you know. That's clear. That's part of the strategy in a way to sort of become clearer ahead. But you got to then come back to compare it with what we've got at the moment. It's not like one's shiny new and, you know, completely untrusted and the other is completely old, completely stable and works wonderfully well. No, in fact, we've got this sort of middle ground, right, where those two things are working together. So it's going to be a very interesting evolution. It's going to move quickly, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a few people in the chat still saying, you know, Bitcoin is crap and whatnot. I think it's kind of like you get to the stage now where are you going to be the old guy that's yelling at the TV and the internet? And, you know, at what stage do you say, well, hold on, it's been the best performing asset on the planet every year bar one or two. More and more people are using it. NASDAQ listed companies are buying it. Legendary fund managers are now buying it. You know, the world is changing and you're kind of being left behind and just burying your head in the sand saying, I don't understand it. just like you, you know, you see your grandparents that don't keep up with, and they don't learn how to use the internet and whatever. And it's not really an excuse, because it is quite easy to understand if you just take that time. You can understand a lot about Bitcoin and why it's important in just an hour conversation like this. So, yeah.
And the point to make as well is that, and the fundamental difference, right? Bitcoin, because there's no centralized control, right? There's no centralized ledger. It's all devolved. Essentially, you own your Bitcoin bit, right?
Yes.
It's not controlled centrally. It's not in a central bank somewhere, right? You hold it. You own it. You control it. Particularly if you've got a cold wallet and you've got that sorted out, that is empowering potentially.
That is also the big risk. So once you're the custodian and you have your keys, then yes, it is your responsibility. There's no one to call if you lose them. But again, the people that are saying it's no good or whatever, you know, go over to one of these countries where they can't move their money, or they can't feed their kids, or they can't start a business without Bitcoin, and go and tell them that it has no use. You know, you get laughed out of these towns where there's now countries where Bitcoin is responsible for 50% of transactions at times in Turkey or Venezuela, Argentina, whether it's Bitcoin or a stablecoin. You know, crypto has become the majority of the currency for e-commerce, for real world commerce. So, you know, you can keep laughing at them, or you can actually accept the fact that this is happening.
We've pretty much come up to the hour, Alex, and you said to me that you needed to dial off at the end of that time. So I just want to say thank you very much for your time this evening. It's been a very interesting conversation. Just want to say to everybody, please like this post. We've only got 132 likes so far, despite the fact we've had more than 600 and nearly 700 viewers. So do like before you go. These days, the YouTube algorithms are not very kind to these types of conversations, right? We need likes. So please like. Alex, if people want to find more about you, where do they go?
Just nuggetsnews.com.au or nuggetsnews.com. YouTube. And thanks for having me on, Martin. I love it when you come on every month and we talk about housing. So glad I could return the favor.
Really appreciate it. And thanks very much for spending some time with us tonight. I'm going to let you go, and I'll just tidy up the show now as we move towards the end part. So thanks, Alex. And I do recommend your channel and, as I say, the monthly show that you and I do on your channel on economics is also worth visiting if you've not seen it, because that goes quite well too. So thanks very much. Have a good evening.
Thanks,
and we'll see you again. Cheers.
See you guys.
Right. And thanks, Alex, for your time today. Really appreciate it. And just to everybody else, we'll close out the rest of the show now. Just to say, I'm not doing postcodes tonight, but the good news is that next week I will be doing postcodes. That will be part of the Household Financial Confidence Update. There's a lot of information coming out with regard to what's going on. I've got some very hot news with regard to JobKeeper and what's happening with JobSeeker, so I'll be able to share some of that. And I look forward to seeing you on that show next week on the 20th. The week after, just so you know, the week after that, there will be a special show on deposit bail-in. And in fact, Robbie Barwick and I will be going into some detail with regard to deposit bail-in, where we are, where the legislation is, and what we can do to try and actually solve that particular problem. I get more questions on deposit bail-in than almost anything else, even now. And so the show in 2 weeks' time, we'll try and cover that. So that's just a bit of a forward view. I want to say thank you very much to everybody for being on the show tonight, and your comments, very appreciative of those. Ron, contribution, thank you. Jason, for your contribution, thank you. It's really appreciated. And I look forward to seeing you next time for our next show. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. We'll see you next time.